33-year-old male found dead a few days ago. Someone amongst them is our killer.
Two loving parents found dead in their home, each killed by a single gunshot.
I would never have thought such unimaginable terror could happen to such a lovely family.
Was it a murder followed by suicide or a calculated execution?
The person we were looking for was clearly very forensically aware. It made our investigation very difficult.
What we knew of this family and what we found at the scene just didn't add up.
Just 3 months earlier, the dead couple's grown-up son was hailed a hero for rescuing his nephew and father from a submerged car. Although the close-knit family had survived this horrific car accident, they would soon be torn apart forever.
For something like that to happen to such lovely people, it's just shocking, terrible. It's the worst thing I've heard.
A complex police investigation would eventually lead detectives to a surprising prime suspect, driven to depravity by greed. Timperley, in Altrincham, Cheshire, a suburban commuter village on the southern edge of Manchester.
Timperley is a small village situated on the outskirts of Greater Manchester, close to the Cheshire Belt. In general, it's a low-crime area.
It became home to Robert and Patricia Seddon, who married in 1966 and settled here to raise their son Stephen and his younger sister Leslie.
Bob worked with British Airways at ground maintenance, liked to laugh, but got on with his job. He did all the jobs that we did at the time, which was push back, meeting the aircraft in, putting ground power on the aircraft. So anything that was required, Bob would do. I know Pat was a cleaner, and Bob used to tell me all the time that, you know, we didn't have to worry about the house when he got back, because it was always clean. Bob and Pat both worked hard, but they also liked, you know, their own time, so they'd have friends round and play cards at home, and they did that on a regular basis. They enjoyed that. Bob's favourite pastime was crown bean bowls. He just used to love playing in bowls. All he ever talked about was bowling. Bob was quite private, but, you know, we'd talk about his family a lot. He loved his family.
In 1975, when Leslie was about 7 years old, she became ill. Her condition deteriorated and she started suffering convulsions. Doctors diagnosed her with having epilepsy.
Bob loved his children, but particularly Leslie. There was a special bond there between those two. He used to tell me about that all the time.
As Leslie grew up, she adapted well to the epilepsy, and that didn't take a smile off her face. She was a bubbly, jolly young lady.
In contrast, Bob and Pat's eldest child, Stephen, was difficult as a teenager. He got involved with the wrong crowd.
When Stephen was growing up, he started getting friendly with some people who were into low-level crime, taking bikes, you know, little things from the house, and yeah, he did get into trouble with the police.
Pat and Bob found it difficult to keep Stephen under control.
Due to Leslie's epilepsy, a lot of attention was drawn to help her, and Stephen at the time didn't like it and decided that he wanted to look elsewhere.
Stephen's persistent offending landed him in more and more trouble with the police, which didn't sit well with Bob.
Even though Stephen had taken the wrong track at the time, Pat was very close to Stephen.
Stephen, what have you done?
Oh, come here.
She would have forgiven him for anything.
In 1987, Bob and Pat were given an opportunity to get onto the property ladder. Bob's mother had recently passed away. She lived in nearby Sale. Keen to keep her house in the family, Bob and Pat decided to buy it. Leslie also moved house with her mum and dad. And Stephen, now in his early 20s, moved into a flat in Manchester.
When Stephen got to the age of 20, he seemed to start to turn his life around, going into the business world.
Along with a friend, he decided to set up a consultancy company.
Have a good day.
And business seemed to be going from strength to strength.
Another happy customer, big man.
A part of a day's work.
Bob and Pat were over the moon with the fact that he had such a good business going.
Bob and Pat were really proud of what Stephen had achieved, and I know Bob used to tell me he had quite a few nice cars, which made me jealous.
His company involved contacting small businesses and offering to source European and national funding grants for them for an upfront fee of £300. The business was so successful that after only 2 years, £5 million had been collected in upfront fees.
We will make this happen for you and you will not be disappointed.
In 1996, Stephen's good fortune continued when he met a young woman in a Manchester nightclub. Romance blossomed, and it wasn't long before the couple were planning a new life together.
Stephen and his new girlfriend moved to the northeast, to the location where her family and friends all lived.
Although they felt sad that Stephen would now be living further away, Pat and Bob were busy with a new arrival at home, Leslie's son Daniel. But as the new grandparents were happily settling into their retirement together, they couldn't have foreseen the terrible accident that lay ahead. In 1996, Bob and Pat Seddon were living in Sale, a leafy commuter suburb south of Manchester. Their 20-year-old daughter, Leslie, who had epilepsy, lived at the family home and had recently given birth to a son, Daniel, who was born with severe learning difficulties. The couple's eldest son, Stephen, had now settled down in the northeast with his wife. They had started a family of their own, and Stephen's consultancy business was still proving to be successful.
Stephen's business took off and was doing really well. He seemed to be making a good go of it and becoming a high flyer in the business world. Bob and Pat couldn't have been any prouder.
But all was not as it seemed.
Hello, is Stephen Seddon in?
Who's asking?
Trading Standards.
He's not in at the moment, he's just gone out.
Well, can you let him know that we need to speak to him? It's a matter of urgency.
I'll let him know.
Thank you.
It transpired in the late 1990s that Trading Standards conducted an investigation that established that Stephen was trading fraudulently.
We will make this happen for you and you will not be disappointed.
Despite Stephen and his business partner promising to find company's grants, they had simply kept the £300 upfront fee each business had paid to them without doing anything in return.
Stephen was very persuasive towards people. He could get them to believe what he wanted them to believe. And if he said to his mother and father, this was this, they believed him.
In March 2000, at Teesside Crown Court, Stephen was found guilty of fraudulent trading charges and sentenced to 1 year in prison. Eight years passed by before the family was hit with tragedy.
Is Leslie not up yet?
On the morning of September the 7th, 2008, Pat realised that her daughter Leslie had not come downstairs for breakfast.
With Leslie not being downstairs, Pat went upstairs and walked into the bedroom.
Leslie? Come on, sweetheart, we're all waiting for you.
Tragically, Leslie had suffered an epileptic seizure during the night and had passed away in her sleep. She was only 40 years old.
Knowing how much Pat and Bob had looked after Leslie, when she passed away, they were absolutely shattered, the pair of them, and devastated.
Despite the fact that Bob and Pat were in their 60s and now retired, They were incredibly devoted to their 12-year-old grandson Daniel and insisted that he stay living with them at home.
It was suggested to Pat and Bob at the time that Daniel should be put in care, but knowing Bob as I do, that was never going to happen.
Bob and Pat eventually agreed for Daniel to spend a day or two a week with a respite carer named Fergus.
Got everything he needs.
See you later.
Pat was stickler for routine, and every time Daniel would come home, Pat would be stood at the window looking out, waiting for the bus to arrive outside. Bob would either leave the front door open or he would go to the end of the drive in his slippers and wait for the transport to bring Daniel back home.
After Leslie passed away, Bob and Pat made changes to their will, as she was no longer a beneficiary. Stephen had offered to take guardianship of Daniel should anything happen to Bob and Pat. After coming out of prison, Stephen, who was also using the alias of Nick Seddon, tried his hand at several jobs. Unfortunately, he couldn't hold any down, and in 2011, he was unemployed. With three children to support, he turned to his parents for financial help.
Bob had released equity from his own home to provide his son and his family with a house of their own. And he'd given £22,500 for deposit on their home and £23,000 cash for Stephen to get him back on his feet.
No matter how upset Bob and Pat had been with Stephen, he was now their only child and they were happy to help him. They loved spending time with their grandchildren, so wanted to make sure they were provided for. In March 2012, Stephen invited his parents and nephew out for a meal. He hired a car from the northeast and drove 140 miles to Sale. He said he wanted to thank his parents for their generosity and to belatedly celebrate Mother's Day.
Not his usual car.
Looks lovely though, doesn't it?
Are you all right, everyone?
Look great, love. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, man. Are you all right? Come on then, we haven't got a lot of time.
Okay.
You all right, Dad?
All right, son.
Yeah, not so bad.
You
all right, Daniel?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Right. Are we all in?
I think so.
Right, make sure you've got your seatbelts on.
Okay, love.
Safety first.
Where's your car then, Steve?
Just nothing serious with the car. It's in the garage at the moment. Just bad timing with today, you know.
It's a nice car though, isn't it, love?
But on the way to the restaurant, disaster struck. As Stephen took a shortcut during their journey, turning to travel alongside the Bridgewater Canal, he suddenly clasped his hand to his chest and appeared to lose concentration.
Slow down, Stephen. Stephen! Stephen! You better slow down, you're going too fast!
Stephen lost control of the car, plunging himself and his family into the dark, cold canal.
Hello. Hi, I'm driving up Canal Road in Tinpley, Manchester, and a car has just driven into the canal.
Okay. Is anybody inside, can you tell?
Well, no one's got out. They literally drove towards me and they sort of didn't stop and then they veered off and gone into the canal.
The police received a call to say that a car containing passengers had plunged into the canal in Tinpley.
There's people in it?
Yeah, I think they're stuck.
Two young lads at the scene from the bank had seen Stephen escape from the car and managed to get himself on top of the roof.
Two young boys that were at the scene saw Stephen clamber onto the top of the car and then they saw him try to smash the car window with his feet.
Witnesses then told us that Stephen was seen to get back in the water, assist his nephew Daniel out of the car, get him towards the bank.
That's it. Come on, keep splashing, keep going. Keep going.
At this point, the police arrived at the scene.
He then returned to the car, helped his father get out of the car. At this point, the police were called to rescue his father, threw him a line and got him out onto the bank.
Hold it tight. You're doing great.
Keep moving. The first thing we heard, we were out and about in the fire engine doing some fire safety, and we heard that a call had come through for a car in the canal.
When I first heard of this incident, it was quite unusual, as it's a once-in-a-lifetime incident to turn out to.
There was a man at the side of the car. He was quite frenzied. He was splashing in the water and shouting for us to get into the water and to get his mother out of the back of the car.
I'm stuck in the water, I can't get her out!
We wanted him rescued first so that we could concentrate on his mother.
The fire brigade were faced with a very serious problem. The car was on the brink of sinking.
When a vehicle's trapped in water, the sheer weight of water which is acting up on the doors means that you physically can't open a door.
To gain access to Pat, they had to break the rear window, which accelerated the descent of the car. By the time they got Pat out, she'd already been underwater for a couple of minutes and her heart had stopped.
While firefighters were getting Pat out of the canal, the police took statements from Stephen and his father, Bob, who were anxiously waiting on the canal bank.
He seemed to have like a seizure or something.
I started getting these pains in my chest, yeah? And then I grabbed all...
Stephen was explaining to emergency services that he'd suffered chest pains immediately prior to the accident and that had been the cause of it. And while he was doing this, he clutched his chest and fell to the ground.
After Stephen had collapsed at the scene, he was taken to hospital to be checked out. He had numerous tests on his heart, but thankfully, they all came back as normal.
While Stephen had escaped the incident relatively unscathed, Pat was in a critical condition and had to be rushed to hospital.
Hey, Stephen.
You all right, Mum? Stephen.
Despite Pat dying at the scene, I'm happy to say that she made a full recovery. In the matter of a few days, the family were back together at home.
A lot of this was due to Stephen's actions, rescuing his father and his nephew.
You saved your family, didn't you?
Stephen was hailed a local hero.
No, I'm not the hero, am I? I mean, I just save people that I love. That's what you do, do you know what I mean?
But just 3.5 months after the terrible car accident, tragedy would strike the family again.
You saved your family, didn't you? I mean,
in March 2012, Stephen Seddon was hailed a hero for rescuing his nephew and father after driving his car into the Bridgewater Canal in Manchester.
I just grabbed him and pulled him out.
Having been devastated by the loss of their daughter, Leslie, 4 years previously, the couple were suffering with depression following the car accident. Pat and Bob struggled on through the next few months, trying to put the past behind them. In July 2012, Daniel's respite carer, Fergus, arrived at Bob and Pat's home to drop Daniel back, but found there was no answer.
At 4:30 p.m. on the 6th of July, we received a 999 call from the respite carer of Daniel.
Emergency.
Hello, I'm a short break foster carer for a child. He's not been able to be dropped off at his own house because his grandparents are not answering the door. I've just been round the back and I've seen his grandfather, and he appears to have a gun in his hand.
Police attended the address, and the scene they were met with was Pat laying in the hallway with an obvious shotgun blast to the head. Bob himself was in the rear lounge, slouched on the couch, with a clear shotgun injury to his chest, and a double-barrel sawn-off shotgun lay across his lap.
Greater Manchester Police thought they could be dealing with a murder followed by a suicide.
First impressions at the scene was that a murder-suicide had taken place, that being that Bob had shot his wife, Pat, and then shot himself.
But Bob's friend and former colleague, Stephen Fawcett, found this theory difficult to believe.
I received a phone call asking me had I heard about Bob. I hadn't, and he said, yeah, and he's, you know, he's killed his wife and then committed suicide. And I couldn't believe it, I was shocked. The other thing was Daniel, to do that and to leave him on his own just didn't fit into the picture I have with Bob and Pat.
Detectives needed to talk to the couple's next of kin.
It was quickly established that the couple had a son called Stephen who lived in the northeast, and obviously it was important that we contacted him as soon as possible.
Stephen's son?
Yeah, what's up?
Can I come in, please, sir?
Death!
On hearing the news, Stephen collapsed to the floor, was crying and clearly distressed. And then he just stopped.
He's going to pay the mortgage.
Stephen began to express his worries about the house and basically talk about how he was going to cope financially.
Stephen's reaction at the time was unusual, but when you're telling somebody that something so severe has happened to your parents, it is quite hard to judge how people will react.
Have you thought about possibly going to Manchester, sir?
No, I can't go down to Manchester, mate. I've had a drink, haven't I?
It was really important for us to establish the circumstances as to how Pat and Bob died.
The first thing we did was to arrange for a Home Office pathologist and a ballistics expert to attend the scene so that they could check out the theory as to whether this was, in fact, a murder-suicide.
There was a full forensics team there. We had local officers doing door-to-door inquiries and also officers doing background checks and medical checks on both Pat and Bob.
Detectives soon had a forensic breakthrough in their investigation.
The ballistics expert and pathologist at the scene were able to establish that the shot that killed Bob wasn't a shot he fired himself. The reason for this is that the size of the shot pattern on his chest indicated that the weapon must have been at least 1.5 metres away from him at the time the round was fired.
This would make it impossible for Bob to actually have fired that gun and shot himself, taking account of those distances.
A second factor which supported that this was not a suicide was that the weapon was found neatly placed across Bob's lap. If he'd held the gun at distance to shoot himself, the recoil alone would have carried that gun away from Bob, and it would have been on the floor somewhere.
Forensic scientists analysing the gun made another discovery, which backed up this theory.
We had two people who'd been killed, and within the shotgun, we had one fired round, one unfired round. And there was no other fired round in the building. Extremely thorough search of the whole property then commenced, looking for this fired shotgun cartridge, and it could not be found anywhere. Whoever had done the killing had removed that shotgun cartridge when they left the scene themselves.
We'd gone from what we thought was a domestic suicide situation to a double murder with an offender out there on the loose.
Right, follow me. Interesting one.
Whilst making routine inquiries, officers spoke to Bob's GP, who informed them of a conversation they'd had during a recent appointment.
Hello there, Bob.
Hello, Doctor.
Take a seat.
The doctor realised that there was something that's wrong. Bob actually said to him, "You would not believe me if I told you." And Bob went on to say there were things about that accident that made him really, really concerned. One of them was that he'd had a crook lock in the car with him when this was a brand new car that wouldn't have needed such a device. Bob had said that on a recent visit to his son's house in the northeast, he'd noticed a Saved documentary which showed you how to get out of a submerged vehicle. The doctor pressed him and Bob said to him that he thought his son had tried to kill him in the accident in the canal in March. The doctor found Bob's concern really difficult to digest, but he could see that Bob was very, very distraught by it all.
This was of great significance to us. Stephen, for the first time, became to look like a potential suspect. We then instructed police in the northeast to arrest him, and he was brought down to Manchester.
Stephen Seddon.
Yeah, what's up?
I'm arresting you on suspicion of the murder of Robert and Patricia Seddon.
That's my parents, man. I wouldn't do that. You got it all wrong.
Stephen was taken to Pendleton Police Station, where police had just 24 hours to question him.
Once we'd decided that Stephen Seddon was a suspect in this, as soon as you declare that and arrest someone, that sets our clock ticking.
The pressure was on to get lines of inquiry in so that we'd be well prepared for the interview process when he landed.
It became quite crucial to the investigation that we established a time of death for Pat and Bob so that we could then work round where Stephen was at the time of those deaths.
We'd already established that Bob had visited his GP on Tuesday the 3rd of July, and from our inquiries locally, what became really apparent was that this was a couple with a very definite set routine, day in, day out. And what part of that routine was that on Wednesday night, Bob would put the bins out for collection on the Thursday, and that hadn't happened.
Pat would do her washing every day. She would put her whites out first. Then once she'd brought them in, she would put her dark washing out. On the Wednesday, the neighbours would say that they saw Pat put her white washing out in the morning, but they never saw her put out her dark wash.
Extensive CCTV inquiries were then commenced, and one of these led to the recovery of footage on a local chippy where Bob could be seen at 5 minutes past 12 on Wednesday the 4th of July, buying what we believe was probably his last meal, the fish and chips. As part of the proof of life inquiries, we looked at the telephony around Bob and Pat's home phone. What became apparent was that Bob had a phone call from social services when he returned from the chippy, and that ended around about 12:24 that day. The first unanswered call comes in at 16:21. An unanswered call doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's died, but it certainly gave us a window to concentrate on.
At this point in the investigation, we knew how Pat and Bob had died, where they'd died, what time. What we didn't know was why they'd died.
During the interview process, Stephen was asked why his father would have said these things to his doctor, and he simply answered,
"No comment."
He was insistent that he was innocent and that we'd got the wrong man.
It's a blinking inquiry. That's what it is. I would not murder my mother and father. Period. You got the wrong man.
During this stage of the inquiry, we looked to see who would benefit from the death of Bob and Pat. And when we looked at the will, what became apparent was that following their daughter's death, there'd been changes made. And now, Stephen was their sole beneficiary. During Stephen's interviews, he gave us an awful lot of no-comment answers to an awful lot of questions. But one thing he was happy to talk about was his movements the week his mum and father had been murdered.
And I did actually go to the room.
Stephen told investigators that he took his family to a caravan park in Fleetwood on Monday the 2nd of July, approximately 2.5 hours' drive from where they live. On the Tuesday night, Stephen remembered that he needed to sign on at the job centre in Seaham, so he left Fleetwood early Wednesday morning to travel back home.
So I get home and I'm like knackered out. So have a couple of drinks, cappuccinos, waiting for me 10 o'clock to sign on. Dozed off, Anna. And then I wake up and it's like, Christ, the car. The car is stuck with the electric garage door down. Obviously, I couldn't just jump in the car. Otherwise, I could have left at the last minute.
Stephen explained that he ran to his appointment at the job centre, after which he took money out from a nearby cash point, where he said he would be seen on CCTV.
He then went home for the rest of the afternoon, where he said he had another sleep. When the electricity was turned back on later in the evening, he was able to recover his car from behind the gate, go to a local shop, buy some beer, and then drive back down to Fleetwood to rejoin his family.
This meant that Stephen had an alibi from first thing in the morning, from going to the job centre and to the cash point, to buy the Chinese beer in the afternoon and going to Fleetwood. What he didn't have was an alibi between the two times, which was around 11 and 4:30.
The police carried out inquiries on Stephen's mobile phone.
And what it showed us is that Stephen's phone was in Seaham all day.
This put a question mark over him as a suspect in his parents' killing.
At this point, Greater Manchester Police had no evidence to place Stephen Seddon at the scene of the crime in Sale. In fact, it appeared he was 145 miles away in the northeast and without access to a car. Working with the police in County Durham, officers were tasked with verifying Stephen's alibi for Wednesday the 4th of July. Detectives started gathering CCTV footage together. They were able to determine that Stephen did indeed leave the caravan site in Fleetwood early on the Wednesday morning, as he had said. And from speaking to staff at the job centre, they collaborated Stephen's account that he had been in CM for his appointment at 10 a.m. and that he'd arrived out of breath because he'd had to run to get there on time.
We then had a breakthrough. When officers viewed the CCTV footage from the CM job centre, on one camera you could see in the distance a car pull up and someone emerged from that vehicle and start making their way towards the job centre. On another camera, we then could see a person who's clearly Stephen Seddon entering the building. What was interesting was that when Stephen left the job centre, he was last seen heading off in the direction of that car. And very shortly later, that car is then seen to move off. If Stephen was using a car that day, we needed to know which car it was. Unfortunately, the footage was not of a quality where we could identify the vehicle, but what was apparent was that a bus had driven past whilst he'd been in the job centre. We were really pleased to see that the CCTV on the bus had captured an excellent image of this vehicle. The only negative aspect of the CCTV footage from the bus was that we couldn't make out the number plate, therefore we weren't able to run it through our systems. What we could clearly see was that this was a 3 Series BMW in blue, and what we really needed to establish was this vehicle connected to Stephen Seddon.
Police began questioning Stephen's family and friends in Seaham to gather more information.
Part of the inquiry up in the North East was to speak to all of Stephen Seddon's family.
Can you tell me when you last saw him?
Whilst interviewing his brother-in-law, he actually mentioned to us that on the morning of the 4th of July, Stephen had called at his house and asked him if he could borrow his car in order for him to go to the job centre.
One of the officers was very interested to see that this particular person owned a blue 3 Series BMW. This was a pivotal moment in the inquiry because despite Stephen telling us on interview that he didn't have access to a car, he clearly did.
The police knew that to drive from Seaham to Sale in Manchester would take around 2.5 hours.
What we could establish was that Bob and Pat were probably killed between 12:30 after the last phone call received by Bob and 16:21, the phone call that was never answered.
This is what we would call our window of opportunity. If we couldn't place Stephen Seddon, or the vehicle that Stephen Seddon had access to, in the Sale area at that time, our own inquiries would ultimately alibi him out as a suspect.
Investigators searching for the killer of Bob and Pat Seddon began to trawl through CCTV footage and automatic number plate recognition systems in both the North East and around the Greater Manchester area.
What we were able to find is a vehicle similar to the blue BMW coming along Manor Road, which is close to Pat and Bob's home, at about 13:35 hours. We then found some further CCTV. This was at 13:59 hours, and this was coming away from the family home of Pat and Bob. At 14:03, the vehicle went past the convenience store again. And then I got the phone call to say that the automated number plate recognition system had picked up a BMW that had gone from the northeast to the Greater Manchester area, and this was within our time frame of the killings.
Discovering that Stephen was the sole beneficiary of his parents' estate, the inconsistencies in his interviews, and the evidence placing the blue BMW in the Manchester area during the window of the murder was enough for Greater Manchester Police to seek charges against him. But they needed more evidence to secure a conviction.
All throughout the investigation, one of the things that we couldn't dismiss at all was what Bob had told his doctor.
Was it a very freaky set of events, or was it actually Stephen Seddon's first attempt at killing his parents?
There were certainly a number of inconsistencies that hadn't been considered previously, which we now concentrated on.
The female witness who phoned 999 said she thought a joyrider was driving towards her because of the speed at which the car was travelling. But Stephen claimed he had lost control of the car because of the sudden chest pains he was having, so it's conceivable that he might have been driving erratically before crashing into the canal. It emerged that Stephen had carried a knife in his pocket, which he used to cut himself out of his seatbelt. He'd also brought a crook lock in the car with him that night, despite being in a hire car which had an immobiliser alarm. He was able to use the lock to smash his way out. But for some reason, didn't use either device as a way of helping others out of the car. The schoolboys who had watched in horror at the side of the canal claimed they had to scream for Stephen to get off the top of the submerged car because he was causing it to sink further. And when Stephen was stood on the side of the canal, he relived the accident before appearing to faint. Stephen underwent a number of medical tests on his heart that evening, but everything appeared to be completely fine.
Part of our investigation into the canal incident was to speak to the car hire company. We were able to establish that Stephen had not only hired a BMW, but a couple of days before, he'd hired another vehicle as well for a family party. The car hire company informed us that Stephen had taken accidental insurance out when he hired the vehicles, but only on the car that crashed into the canal.
When you added together Bob's comments to his doctor about his suspicions in relation to the crash, Stephen's varying explanations about why the crash had happened, his heart condition that couldn't be detected, his added insurance on the car that was ultimately going to wind up in the canal, this all strongly points to the fact that Stephen had, in March that year, tried to kill his family by driving them into the canal.
There were just too many coincidences for the crash to have been an accident.
On the 12th of July 2012, we charged Stephen Seddon with the attempt murder and murder of his father, Bob Seddon, and his mother, Patricia Seddon.
Greater Manchester Police were successfully able to charge Stephen Seddon, but they needed to gather a lot more evidence for the jury to be as convinced of Stephen's guilt. Police investigating the deaths of Bob and Pat Seddon had charged their son Stephen with their murders, along with an earlier attempt on their lives when Stephen crashed the car they were travelling in into the Bridgewater Canal.
We now had enough evidence to bring charges against Stephen Seddon, but we did now have to start putting the case together to bring it before a court. Part of our investigation would be to speak to everybody that knew Stephen in the Seam area. Some weeks before Pat and Bob were killed, Stephen was drinking in the Mitchell Arms and the landlady was talking to him.
Unless they find somebody to buy it soon, I'm going to lose my home and lose my job.
Hearing about this opportunity, Stephen decided he would like to buy the Mitchell Arms in Seam and try his hand at being a landlord.
Stephen even went as far as to meet with the owners to discuss the purchase of the pub, and the owners actually believed that he was financially viable and that he did have those funds and that that purchase was going to go ahead.
The police took a closer look at Stephen's financial situation.
The investigations into Stephen's finances showed us that he had only about £5 in his account when we arrested him. He was really close to the breadline. He was on benefits, and this was despite his father giving him £23,000 some months before. All that money was gone, and he really was in quite dire straits when it came to money. He had no savings whatsoever and certainly didn't have any of his own finances which would enable him to buy a pub such as the Mitchell Arms.
The police were still unsure at this stage how a sawn-off double-barrelled shotgun found its way into the home of Bob and Pat.
It didn't have any serial numbers on it, which caused us problems. So what we did was we started to look at domestic burglaries and see if a weapon of a similar type had been stolen recently. And we actually found one in a place called Crook. We took a photograph of the gun to the owner of the weapon and he immediately recognised it without any shadow of a doubt. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Crook is a village in the northeast and it is a short distance from Seam. So how did a gun from the northeast wind up in Bob Seddon's lap?
The final pieces of evidence the police needed to examine were Stephen's phone records on the day of the murder.
From telephone records, we can tell that Stephen rang the home of Bob and Pat that Wednesday morning. We'll never know what was actually said in that conversation. What we suspect happened was that Stephen made that call simply to ascertain that Bob and Pat were at home and what their plans were for that day.
When we were investigating the phones, one of the things that really concerned me was the fact that his phone was in Seam, and we'd been able to establish that that phone had possibly been answered. This was an area that, when it went to court, he could use as a defence to say that my phone was in Seam, it was answered, and I answered it.
Stephen was getting an awful lot of texts and calls, which was usual for Stephen. What was unusual was that these were going unanswered, all but one. And what was troubling for us is that we knew at that time the phone was in Seam and we believed that Stephen was on his way, travelling south, to kill his mum and dad. So how was that phone answered if Stephen wasn't with it? What was also interesting was that a lot of these unanswered calls were from loan companies. And as it transpired, the one that had been answered was from a loan company.
We found out what the businesses were and obviously asked them if they had recorded these calls, which thankfully for us they had.
At this point, Stephen was regularly using the alias Nick Seddon.
Can I speak to Nick, please?
You'll have to phone back later.
Is he not available?
No.
All right, we'll give him a call later on then.
Have you got a
We were able to recover a call that Stephen Seddon had answered to another loan company a couple of days earlier.
I'll speak to Nick.
Speaking.
Hi Nick, just a quick call to see if you're interested in going ahead with the loan application today.
Does it charge you money though, before you get the loan?
We do charge a fee if we can guarantee you a loan.
Yeah, I've heard all that before, it's a scam. No, thanks.
When we compared those two audio files, they clearly weren't the same person.
The pieces of the puzzle had finally come together, and Greater Manchester Police felt they had a clear picture of what had happened on Wednesday, the 4th of July, 2012.
What we believed had happened is that Stephen Seddon took his family down to the caravan in Fleetwood on the Monday so that they would be out of the area. Stephen knew that it had to be in Seaham to sign on the Wednesday morning, and he also knew that the electricity company were going to turn the power off that day because he received a letter some weeks earlier telling him that.
He parked his car behind the electric garage gate, knowing it would be trapped inside.
Despite Stephen telling us that he had no vehicle, he borrowed his brother-in-law's car, which he took to the job centre.
CCTV footage showed Stephen drawing cash out of a cash point.
The BMW was then picked up on CCTV, driving towards another family member's address, where Stephen planned to leave his mobile phone. He then drove down to Manchester, taking a detour on the way to buy the gun from an associate.
He arrived at his mother and father's address at approximately 13:40 and crept through the back door.
He aimed the gun towards his father, and before he had a chance to get out of the chair, Stephen shot Bob in the chest.
We believe his mum was hoovering upstairs at the time, and having heard the noise, made her way downstairs to investigate.
Bob?
Meanwhile, Stephen reloaded the gun, removing the empty cartridge which he kept hold of. He then confronted his mother in the hallway.
Oh my God, no!
Stephen then placed the gun in his dead father's lap to give the impression that it had been his father who had fired the shots.
Stephen then left the house and drove back up to Seaham.
Having arrived back in Seaham, Stephen had travelled to a local retail park where he met up with a family member to recover his phone.
He returned home, by which stage the electricity was back on and he recovered his car from behind the electric gate.
He's then seen to go towards a store where he buys some beer and he's seen on CCTV chatting on his phone. He stopped at a petrol station to get petrol before carrying on to Fleetwood.
Stephen's trial began on the 20th of February 2013 and was held at Manchester Crown Court, where he pleaded not guilty. His explanation for being in Manchester on Wednesday the 4th of July was that he was on a drugs run near to his parents' house at the time they were murdered.
This is a really difficult case because you have to convince 12 people on a jury that a son could murder the mother and father, and the motive being money.
Stephen Seddon was a salesman, he was a con artist, he manipulated people, and it was a worry that he'd be able to convince enough jury members that he was an innocent man.
35 days after the trial began, the jury made their decision. After 18 hours of deliberation, the jury found Stephen Seddon guilty of the murder and attempted murder of his parents. He was given a 40-year minimum sentence without parole.
When the guilty verdict came back, I was very, very pleased.
He really did think he was smarter than the police and he was going to get away with this.
Stephen is money, money, money. All he wants is money. Money, as they say, is the root to all evil. In this case, it shows.
Had Stephen got away with this crime and pocketed the money from his parents' estate, how quickly would that have lasted him? And if he spent it at the rate he'd spent money that his father had gave him, within 18 months, 2 years, he would have had nothing left.
And despite resolving the case, detectives were still left with a final concern for the elderly victims.
We hoped that at the time they were killed, Bob and Pat didn't understand who was doing this to them, that he wore a mask or a balaclava or whatever, because I thought that they, at that moment, recognised their son as the person behind the gun. Is horrific beyond words.
Bob and Pat, you know, they were lovely people, you know, worked hard all their lives, you know, looked after, you know, all the family. And for something like that to happen to such lovely people, it's just shocking, terrible. It's the worst thing I've heard.